Welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. In the background, well, that's the music of Astor Piazzolla, as performed by Jeremy Cohen, violinist with the Quartet San Francisco, who will be performing with the Peninsula Symphony this weekend in Redwood City and Cupertino. Colorful tango dancers Sandor and Parissa will join the quartet and the full Peninsula Symphony for an exciting couple of evenings ahead. And at the end of the hour today on Open Air, I'll have some tickets to give away for that. Pianist Jeffrey Siegel, in town for a keyboard conversation concert in Saratoga, will be my guest in studio, as will critic Peter Robinson, who will share details of the Mostly British Film Festival, which opens today with some excellent new movies and time-honored classics. And to begin, Peter Callender of the African American Shakespeare Company joins me. Stay tuned. At San Francisco in Astor Piazzolla's Libertango. My first guest here on Open Air is Peter Callender, who is artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. An actor, writer, and director for over 30 years himself, he received his formal training in theater at the Juilliard School in New York and has appeared on Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional theaters across the United States and abroad, including more locally the California Shakespeare Theater, for which he is an associate artist, Berkeley Rep, ACT, the New York Shakespeare Festival, and many others. In addition to his directing the current African-American Shakespeare Company production of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, he directed the company's production last season of A Raisin in the Sun and Twelfth Night. Peter Callender, welcome to KLW.
Nice to be back. You guys are awesome. Thank you.
I should say, nice to have you back here.
Thank you.
KLW. Well, let's talk a little bit about the great Tennessee Williams.
Yes.
Along with Glass Menagerie, which he wrote in 1944, and Streetcar Named Desire in 47, for which he won a Pulitzer, and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, 55, written and also a Pulitzer. It makes an amazing trilogy of American theater.
He's pretty good, isn't he? yeah, he knows. He knows how to put pen to paper. I've done two of those plays. Well, I've directed. I'm directing Cat, and I did Streetcar Named Desire at ACT. And he's a prolific writer. He speaks of truth. He speaks of family. His characters are bright and brilliant and enduring. Just an amazing, amazing playwright. It's a pleasure to have him, to have his words spoken on our stage.
Now, you said that James Earl Jones was an inspiration to you, not only as an actor, but for his performances in a black cast of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. When was that done?
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with James Earl Jones?
Yeah.
A few years ago.
Actually,
not a few years ago. Last year, with one of my favorite actresses in the world, Anika Noni Rose, directed by Debbie Allen. I love James Earl Jones. I had a chance to meet him years ago when I saw Ethel Fugard's Master Harold and the Boys years ago in New York. we all know James Earl Jones from Darth Vader, from, but the man is
this. This is CNN. Yes,
exactly. Luke. But other than the voice, he is an amazing gentleman, an amazing man, a gentleman, a supportive actor. But to read some of the stuff that he talked about when he played Big Daddy is just astounding. One of the things that he said that he's from that era. He considered himself as. And I have a note here. He considers himself he's a Mississippi farm person, and he's not any different than Big Daddy. He could be caustic, he could be vulgar, he could be rude, and I really believe that there's no difference in the black aesthetic or the white aesthetic or the black experience or the white experience, and I believe that he felt that way too when he played Big Daddy.
Can we talk about that just a little bit mm-hmm. now? Was special permission needed from Tennessee Williams for the estate to have an all-black cast done of the play?
If there was, we are in trouble. no, there wasn't. As long as we say his words.
Interesting. Okay.
As long as we don't change the text.
And that text went through many revisions, mm-hmm. Partially for the subject matter, which back in 1955 was quite controversial.
Quite controversial.
Now, let's back up a second mm-hmm. here as well. Now, it may be hard to believe that anyone doesn't know the story of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, but I know that anything's possible in radio.
Go ahead. Uh-huh.
And besides, we may be exposing a new listener to something they've never heard of before. So let's, in a nutshell, give us the story of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Beautiful, bruising play. The Pollitt family, rich, southern, black.
In this case.
family, Big Daddy, Big Mama, Brick, Maggie. Brick and Maggie are married. Brick is an athlete, a very, very strong, powerful young man, accused of feeling, oh man, how do I start? Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, the Pollitt family. Brick and Maggie are married. The marriage is in trouble. It's been talked about that Brick has homosexual tendencies. His wife wanted to expose that or to dissuade him from that.
She super sexes herself up for that.
Super sexes herself up and approaches the young man who is in love with her husband and throws herself on him. He realizes that he is gay, and he realizes that he can't go on, and literally kills himself. Brick, his best friend, has mourned his death ever since, and blames Maggie, his wife, for the death of his friend Skipper. So their marriage is in deep, deep, deep trouble. Big Daddy is the play takes place on his 65th birthday. The family. Holds back the truth from Big Daddy. Mendacity. Holds back the truth from Big Daddy that the fact that he is actually dying of cancer, and he doesn't know it until late in the play. As a matter of fact, Brick is the one that tells him. And of course, he becomes very abusive, and he's in pain, and he becomes very abusive, and his love for a Big Mama, his wife of 40 some odd years, is dwindling. He hasn't written a will. Maggie feels that the estate is going to be taken away from his favorite son, Brick, and given to his not so favorite son, Goopa. Goopa and May are married. They have 6 children, known as No Neck Monsters, as some of us may have heard.
Mendacity of it all.
Right. The play is
so rich.
It's very rich.
Oh my God!
It's very rich. The destructive power of truth, of lies. Everyone lies to each other, thinking that that's the best way to deal with these things. When the truth finally comes out, it hurts. It hurts. And I'll leave that as a little surprise.
Okay. Well, your casting has got to be in the shadows of what is truly one of the most memorable movies of all time, mm-hmm. starring Elizabeth Taylor, Paul Newman, Burl Ives. So tell me about the cast you've assembled for a live production of this and an all African American cast.
All African American cast. I couldn't be more lucky as a director. I've got ZZ Moore as Maggie. ZZ just graduated from Denver Center Theater. She is quite wonderful, subtle, warm, very sexy, very beautiful, very lithe, moves very well on stage. Tyrone Davis, a recent graduate of Southern California, Cal Arts, young, vibrant actor, talented. Peter Temple plays Big Daddy. He's worked with us before. Eleanor Jacobs, who was my Lena in Raisin, plays Big Mama with joy and pathos and tears. She'll make you laugh and make you cry within an instant. Sean J. West plays Goopa. Yasmina Kay plays his wife, his ever-pregnant wife, now having almost dropping her sixth child. Alex Alexander plays Dr. Bao, and the cast is rounded out by Robert Henry Johnson, who plays the preacher.
Well, it sounds like it.
It's a tremendous cast. I'm fantastic. Very, very happy. And plus, we have a few no-neck monsters as well.
I'll mention again, but let me just mention right now that the production runs from January 26th through February 17th.
It's a limited run.
At the Burial Clay Theater at the African American Art and Culture Complex on Fulton Street at Webster in San Francisco. What I'd like you to address a little bit is why is there a need for an African-American Shakespeare company?
Sherry Young, our executive director, I always called her one of the hardest people in the business. Almost 20 years ago, 19 years ago, Sherry came out of ACT and said, and I totally agree with her, that's why I'm there. She said, there's no place for young actors coming out of these conservatories. There's no place for them to go. They either come out of ACT or PCPA or Solano College or whatever university or whatever training camp they come out of, and they leave. They don't stay in the Bay Area. We needed a place for these actors of color, whether it's African-American, Asian, Hispanic, whatever, actors of color, primarily African-American, but certainly of all races, to have a place where they can build their resumes, where they can play kings and queens and dukes, where they can play Williams and Moore, I'm sorry, and Miller and Shakespeare and Ibsen and Marlowe and Chekhov and and Oscar Wilde, and play these roles and get some confidence and build their resumes, and then they can take off and go to the New York, Chicago theater arena and be confident. An African American Shakespeare Company, that is our mission. We do the classics with color. Get these and these stories. I must add, these stories are not just European stories. I mean, who says the Death of a Salesman can only be done with a white act, with a white cast? I mean, it's a family. It's a family issue. African American Shakespeare Company was founded with that premise. And over the years, I think we've had tremendous success.
Well, let's get back to the plot of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which I think it's a rather appropriate for an African-American cast to address the topics in such a masterwork as the Tennessee Williams play, as, I guess, underlying that love that dare not speak its name is very difficult, especially in the African-American community, it seems.
The love that dare not speak its name?
Now it proclaims its name. It's the homosexuality aspect of the plot.
Right.
I think in an African-American community, it's still difficult to talk to.
It is. And imagine there's this young man, Rick Pollitt. He's an athlete. He's a jock. He's very handsome, strong, articulate. And these undercurrents of homosexuality coursing through his blood, and he's feeling it. He tells a story later in the play of what happens when a young man actually proclaims his sexuality in school, and how everyone ostracized him. And there is Brick Pollitt, comes from this incredibly popular family, and that blood is coursing through his veins. How does he deal with it? What does he say? What doesn't he say? Don't ask, don't tell. He marries a beautiful debutante in Maggie, who adores him, and then of course she fights for him. She fights to say, and Maggie will do anything in the world to get her husband back with her, to forgive him, to have him forgive her. In the African American community, as you said, nowadays it's a little different. People talk about it more readily, but still, in the African American community, it is a taboo, and it is addressed powerfully in this play.
And Peter, as director, what are you bringing to the production?
Look, I feel that I wanted to show that underneath their weakness, underneath the weakness, underneath the cruelty, the sheer mendacity, these people are driven by love. They're driven to tell their story, that love sometimes causes us to make really, really terrible mistakes. And these people also have an incredible heart. And I think if I can bring that out in this production, that yes, we all make mistakes. We all strive to be honest with each other, to love each other, but we do make mistakes. And this can happen in any culture, in any family, in any situation. And this play is actually one of my favorites, and I'm so thrilled to have it done here.
Well, I'm so pleased you could take a little bit of time with us today. Peter Callender, best wishes with this production.
Thank you so much.
And
I appreciate it.
Let's have you on again for the next production.
I appreciate it. Opening January 26th. Thank you.
The 26th through the 17th of February, the African American Shakespeare Company presents Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. It's at the Burial Clay Theater at the African American Art and Culture Complex, 762 Fulton Street at Webster, here in San Francisco. More information at www.african-americanshakes.org. Still to come, a talk about the British Film Festival that's getting underway. Peter Robinson here. And Jeffrey Siegel will be joining me shortly to talk about keyboard conversations. Stay with us. I'm David LaTulip, and you're listening to Open Air. Pianist Jeffrey Siegel performing Edvard Grieg's Wedding Day at Trollhagen from his Keyboard Conversations CD. On the Grieg front, I should mention first that apart from the piano version, which is an incredible version by Jeffrey Siegel, this weekend the San Francisco Symphony presents a fantastic multimedia production of Peer Gynt, which features Ron Huber as Peer Gynt, a cast of several, and the symphony of more than 100, led by Michael Tilson Thomas. It's a multimedia production. You really want to catch that, and Music of Grieg is part of that, as well as by Robin Holloway and Alfred Schnittke. Robin Holloway, my guest last week, talking a little bit about the extravaganza that is Peer Gynt, happening at the San Francisco Symphony Friday and Saturday. But my next guest, Jeffrey Siegel, has been piano soloist with some of the world's great orchestras abroad. These include the Berlin Philharmonic, London Symphony, Philharmonic and Philharmonia, Moscow State Symphony, Munich's Bayerischer Rundfunk, the Amsterdam, Oslo and Stockholm Philharmonics, Orchestra of La Scala and NHK Symphony of Japan. Here in the States, engagements include the New York and L.A. Philharmonics, the Philadelphia and Cleveland Orchestras, the Boston and Chicago Symphony Orchestras, and I'm sure I'm leaving a few of those out, but welcome to you, Jeffrey Siegel.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, you're in town this week for performances in Saratoga, and you'll be returning later this spring for concerts in Palo Alto. Such a pleasure to have you, and my radio partner in commentary, critic Peter Robinson, is also going to chime in every now and again. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to see you.
We'll talk about the film festival in a little bit, too, but feel free to pepper away some questions for Jeffrey. Now, Jeffrey, these keyboard conversations that we just excerpted the Grieg from, you mentioned that these offer a listener and if you're in the audience, something more than a pleasant earwash of sound. Tell us what these are all about, these keyboard conversations.
Keyboard conversations are concerts with commentary. They're not lectures about musical examples. They are concerts with commentary. Each work on a keyboard conversation program is performed in its entirety, as one would expect at a live concert. What we like to think of as being the plus is that prior to the performance of each work, I speak to the audience briefly about the piece that they are going to hear, and I do this with the hope that whatever I say to the listener about the composition before he hears it will enhance the listening experience and also provide a rather inviting and accessible introduction to the work for people who may not have had it before. And the program is a particularly attractive one Saturday night. It's called Gershwin and Friends. And we'll have not only music of Gershwin, like Rhapsody in Blue, but music of composers who were inspired by Gershwin and who inspired Gershwin himself.
I should mention that your recording of Gershwin's complete works for piano and orchestra with Leonard Slatkin and the St. Louis Symphony continues to be a bestseller. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And I was going to add, because I have attended one of Jeffrey's keyboard conversations, and particularly with Rhapsody in Blue, what I found most helpful sitting there in the audience was to see the piece broken down into segments. It raised the question, and Jeffrey addressed it, whether this is an episodic composition. And then at the end, when he has played the entire piece, he is still at the piano taking questions from the audience. And I think it's a really wonderful exchange to have a performance explained. And then if you want to go over something, to have the pianist replay a section and the audience have their questions answered. And I think that's one of the great advantages of keyboard conversations.
And having listened to your CD, The Romance of the Piano, which is one of the keyboard conversations we heard the Grieg from, I should mention that that CD also goes through several works of Chopin and Liszt. It's nice that it's not dumbed down by any means, and you're not just speaking to the amateur, you're also speaking to someone that knows a little bit about music.
The audiences for the keyboard conversation programs, and I do them as ongoing series now in 22 different cities, the audiences are made up of people of all ages and all listening experiences. I have people who've never been to a concert before who want to give classical music a try, and I have people like Peter in the audience, who, of course, have heard these pieces many times, and I don't want to bore him. So it's a real challenge to be able to do the programs for people of different listening experiences. But the whole idea is to make listening to great music more than a pleasant earwash of sound, and really to involve the listener and to intensify and enhance the listening experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're based on the East Coast. And you must have known, I've got to share an anecdote about Grieg with you, since we started with the Grieg, the radio show of Carl Haas.
Yes.
You must know Carl. I mean, I remember tuning into him when I was a youngin' and got me hooked on some music and made me laugh as well as think a little bit. And I remember one of his shows, he always used to have an interesting title for his shows. It was, today, we're going to explore the lesser Scandinavian composers. And I called the show, It's All Grieg to Me. So, I don't think you add that kind of humor to it. But you do add an interesting anecdote. Having listened to The Romance of the Piano last night, I really enjoyed the anecdotes about composers that we take into our music consciousness, these people as titans. And then you come up with something when you're talking about Chopin. Here is this weak, tubercular, 90-pound Frederick Chopin writing fortissimo. It's a very humanizing way to bring a composer to reality.
It's hard for us. It's so well put, David. They are giants. They are titans, and we think of them that way. But they also were human beings. And they are thinking, feeling, sensitive human beings who are able to express infinite thoughts through musical expression rather than words. And we call these works classic because, though they're products of their time, Rhapsody in Blue, for example, the Jazz Age, the Roaring Twenties, like all great music, it transcends its time as well as being of its time. And that's why we call it classic. It's the best that there's ever been.
I think one of the things I learned in Geoffrey's introduction, and maybe you can tell us the story of how Gershwin came to compose Rhapsody in Blue, because I never knew he was a billiard player.
Well, actually, I'd like you to hold that thought on Gershwin, because I want to just address one more thing in the romance of the piano, if we could, before we talk about your concerts while you're here. Let me reset for a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm David LaTulippe, host of Open Air. I'm here with Geoffrey Siegel, who's in town for a keyboard conversation on some American music, Gershwin and Friends at the Montalvo Arts Center in Saratoga, Saturday evening. And he has a series of keyboard conversation CDs out. We're talking as well about one called The Romance of the Piano, and including some Grieg selections and a work by Franz Liszt, which I was surprised to learn about, his Bagatelle of 1885, not published until 1956.
Right.
That's pretty amazing for someone that is so well known to not only pianists, but the world. How did that come about?
David, in my opinion, Franz Liszt is the most misunderstood and unjustly underestimated of all the great composers. We know him essentially by a handful of short pieces, yet only Bach was more prolific than Liszt. And particularly the works that Liszt writes towards the end of his life, which are Introvert, which really predate, if you will, Bartok and Scriabin and people like that. These are fascinating pieces of music, and the Bagatelle Without Tonality is one of these compositions that you listen to and you can't imagine that it's written by Franz Liszt and that it's written by a composer of the 19th rather than the 20th century.
All right, give us your keyboard conversation about the Bagatelle Without Tonality, then.
It could just as well be called Mephisto Waltz Number 4, and it is in waltz time, but the tonality, the harmonies, are constantly shifting, and you don't feel, as you're hearing the piece, that you're walking on solid ground. We're beginning to go into the realm of Debussy, for example, in this regard. And as you hear the piece, he's giving you one sort of macabre-sounding phrase after another, leaving you hanging in the air at the end. And at the very end of the piece, instead of a nice, solid, final chord, he leaves you what I call a question mark chord, where you say, is that all? Is that the end of the piece? And I think this is what he's trying to express. There are question marks in life, as well as conclusions and beginnings. And for a man who enjoyed the pleasures of earthly life beyond what most of us can imagine.
The rock star of the 1880s.
And also was a deeply, deeply religious man, where his Catholic faith was of utmost importance. And when he was in his early 50s, he became an abbé, Franz Liszt, and wore a monk's cloth.
He's probably worn out, to tell you the truth.
Well,
adoring.
It's interesting. People would see him walking down the street who knew him, and he's wearing this monk's cloth, and they would say, ah, there goes Mephistopheles in a monk's cloth. And you get in these late pieces, I think, the huge questions of life that he's asking himself. And the Bagatelle of Tonality, I think, is one of those. And the fact that it's not a popular concert piece is one of the reasons, to answer your question, David, that I think it waited so long to be published.
Well, I'm sorry we don't have a piano in studio here. Maybe in our next set of studios we'll manage to have a grand piano for you. But we have the next best thing. Here is you performing on the CD, The Romance of the Piano, Liszt's Bagatelle Without Tonality from 1885.
Thank you.
A rather interesting ending to that bagatelle without tonality of Franz Liszt. You're right, Jeffrey. And beautifully performed, by the way.
Thank you.
That's from Jeffrey Siegel, my guest's CD called The Romance of the Piano. It's a keyboard conversation series on the Random House audio label. You can also get a keyboard conversation called The Power and Passion of Beethoven, The Romanticism of the Russian Soul, and Mozart and Friends. And Jeffrey, I understand there's some other keyboard conversations that you have in the works or out already.
There are. There are three or four more. And there's also a television program, which I know has been played here, that I did for PBS, a one-hour program, The Glories of the Piano or something of that nature. I think there's a greater need than ever before for... People want to understand what they're listening to. They want their listening experience to be something more than just, you know, passive listening. And there are many people out there who know they're missing something, not to have Beethoven in their life. And they're looking for what a friend of mine called a gentle inoculation into the joys of listening to classical music. Especially, and I believe the keyboard conversations can help in this regard.
Especially given the dearth and everyone always says, oh, we got to get music back in the school. And it seems to be a conversation that's going on for generation after generation. We're just losing people to have this kind of appreciation. So it does fill a tremendous need. And I think we're a much richer place thanks to these keyboard conversations projects like it.
And I think also at the beginning, Jeffrey always says it's to educate and inform as well as to engage and entertain. And I think in that context, what you have been talking about in relation to the schools nowadays is that you'll hear a piece... And then you'll wonder, well, where did that come from? Who wrote it? What was the time period? How did it come about? And I think those are all the types of questions that do get answered in these keyboard conversations.
Well, that makes a great gift, as they say, to a friend who may not have been exposed to music like this. It's wonderful. Jeffrey will be back in April to play the music of Chopin in Palo Alto, and in May, Bach and the Romantics in Palo Alto. And he's here in town now for Gershwin and Friends this Saturday, the 19th, at Montalvo Arts Center in Saratoga. Information for the concert there at montalvoarts.org. Let's talk about a little bit this Gershwin and Friends concert.
Yes, we're going to have works of Gershwin, obviously, on the program.
And some of his friends, I imagine.
And some of his friends. Rhapsody in Blue, but not the way we normally hear it. Gershwin made a solo piano version of Rhapsody in Blue, so he could play it without the jazz band, without the orchestra, where he takes the already very virtuoso solo piano part, David, and he adds to it the orchestra part, making a very full score to play. And in the course of hearing this familiar piece in an unfamiliar way, I will also, in talking about the piece, address the question, really, is it such a badly composed piece of music as it's often given credit for being? We'll also have some early works of Gershwin, The Rialto Ripples, his very first published composition. But we're also going to have music on the program that inspired Gershwin, works of the first well-known, internationally recognized American composer Louis Moreau Gottschalk, Edward McDowell's very popular To a Wild Rose, which has a very interesting origin. And then we're going to have music...
Share us a little bit about the To a Wild Rose.
To a Wild Rose, I mean, McDowell was perhaps the most notable American composer of the second half of the 19th century. And he wrote a lot of piano music. There's one piece of his which is universally famous, certainly in our country, and it's a short piano piece he writes in 1896 called To a Wild Rose, which evokes a past, simpler, seemingly more peaceful time. What I found very interesting about this is that the composer didn't like it and tossed it in the wastebasket. And his wife, who was a trained musician, happened to see the manuscript in the wastebasket, and she picked it up and looked at it, and she realized the quality of that which she saw. So she went to her husband, and she begged him to reconsider, to publish the work rather than have it perished. He listened to his wife, he published the work, and it became his most popular, best-selling composition. And I have to tell you, David, that this is a story that's a particular favorite of my wife's.
Ah, okay.
Listen to the wife. So we'll also have music that, shall we say, Gershwin inspired. Two later American composers, Leonard Bernstein and Aaron Copland, and we'll be hearing works of their.
I understand you got some particularly encouraging words from Lenny B. early on.
he was familiar with what I'm doing with the keyboard conversations, and it was the week, actually, I was soloist with the New York Philharmonic with Zubin that I had a conversation with Mr. Bernstein, where he said to me, I know where you got this idea of talking about music, and the format that you're using is exactly mine, and I've been hearing wonderful things about the way you do it from Maggie Carson and friends of mine who attend, and I just want you to know I'm delighted you're using my format for the piano literature, and keep on doing what you're doing.
Well, good for you. That's nice. That's a nice pedigree to have to mention for him. Gershwin and Friends at the Montalvo Arts Center. Once again, montalvoarts.org. Let's talk a little bit more about the Rhapsody in Blue and your discovery of Gershwin's piano version of it, as opposed to what you maybe grew up with.
Mm. Yeah, I played, when I was growing up in Chicago, I played a lot of jazz in my youth. And of course, it's been said many times that Gershwin's music is ideal for somebody who's got one foot in the jazz hall and one foot in the concert hall. And I had the great privilege and pleasure with my dear friend Leonard Slatkin of recording all the piano and orchestra works of Gershwin with the St. Louis Symphony many years ago. So Gershwin's music has always been very close to my heart, and I've played a lot of it. To be able to play Rhapsody in Blue on your own without having to drag along a jazz band or an orchestra is a particular pleasure. I don't know. It certainly doesn't have the color and the variety of color that one has when you hear it the way he composed it to be with the band. But it has a certain value. People say it's like seeing a color movie now in black and white. You sort of see more details than you might have otherwise.
Gershwin didn't orchestrate the Rhapsody, did he?
He didn't actually put every note in the orchestra part himself, but when he handed the music to Ferdy Groffet to orchestrate, Gershwin was quite specific already in his piano score about what instruments he wanted to play what parts. Groffet did the work, but he didn't just take a piano score with no directions from the composer. The composer had some very specific ideas of how he wanted it played.
Yeah, I liked particularly your story about him playing billiards and reading in the newspaper what he was meant to be writing. Can you tell us that one?
Yeah, Gershwin, on a cold winter night in January 1924, Peter, was actually in a game of billiards with a friend in a pool hall in New York City on Broadway. And his brother Ira rushed in with that evening's edition of the New York Herald Tribune, which had an article saying that Gershwin was hard at work writing a new piece for piano and jazz band, which would be premiered in 3 weeks' time with Paul Whiteman and his jazz orchestra. And no one was more surprised to read this article than Gershwin. And yet, he knew he had the deadline, and in 3 weeks it was done. And it was a tremendous success when it was performed.
Well, I wish you every success in these concerts at the Montalvo Arts Center. It's going to be Gershwin and Friends Saturday evening. Jeffrey Siegel, a keyboard conversation. More with Peter Robinson in just a moment. Jeffrey, we thank you for taking some time with us today, and we look forward to maybe seeing you when you come back for the music of Chopin in April.
I would like that very much. It's been a pleasure talking music with you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're most welcome. And please tell us the version of the Gershwin that we're going to hear on the CD. I understand it's a live performance.
Yes, this was recorded live in concert a few years ago in St. Petersburg, Florida, by WEDU, their PBS station there. So you're not hearing an edited version, you're hearing something live, and hopefully it captures that which is live in a performance.
Jeffrey Siegel performing Rhapsody in Blue, George Gershwin. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
Pianist Jeffrey Siegel performing live in Russia that piano solo version of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Jeffrey appearing in a program called Gershwin and Friends, a keyboard conversation at the Montalvo Arts Center Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. Information at montalvoarts.org. And you can learn more about Jeffrey's projects and these keyboard conversations at the website KeyboardConversations.com. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulip here now with Peter Robinson, who's going to share some information about an upcoming film festival. Or is it already underway?
No, you're absolutely right, David. It's called Mostly British Films, and mostly is the adjective, adverb rather, to qualify films from Australia, from Ireland, and from the UK. And it's a very interesting blend of both classics and new, freshly released movies. And just listening to that Rhapsody in Blue, one of the movies is Brief Encounter, which, of course, has Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto as the theme that draws Trevor Howard and Celia Johnson and that whole crew together as we launch into a railway station where the Brief Encounter takes place. And it's, again, a David Lean-directed film.
I did not realize that. Wow.
Yeah. So that's something to look forward to. Noel Coward, of course, was the author on Brief Encounter.
What are the other classics that are being presented as part of the festival?
Well, it's actually opening with this Happy Breed, which is another Noel Coward production. And the early ones are more modern. The Deadly Affair that stars James Mason and, Odd Man In, which stars James Mason, and The Deadly Affair, which is actually based on an early John le Carré story before The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, when he was writing mainly murder mysteries. Now, a word or two about the mostly Brit Film Festival. It does take place at the Vogue Theatre, here in town. It runs for 1 week. The opening is tonight, and it runs until next Thursday. And some of the films, particularly the film noir, the British film noir, are introduced by author Tony Broadbent. He is a mystery and thriller writer. His period is, in fact, the 1950s, so he's an ideal person to take us into the history of those early days in British film studios. And he will be introducing both Odd Man In and The Deadly Affair. And then I've mentioned Brief Encounter. And we then move on to some current movies which haven't been released. And one of these is called Hunky Dory. It stars Minnie Driver. It includes music from David Bowie, Lou Reed, The Beach Boys, Simon and Garfunkel, Dusty Springfield, and the Electric Light Orchestra. And it's a story which actually came from the producers of Billy Elliot. It's set in a classroom who are looking to put on a musical for the end-of-term production. The music is to The Tempest, the Shakespeare play. I know you were talking early on to the, about Shakespeare. And it's really amazing how they've managed to blend both contemporary music, a historic piece of Shakespeare, and brought it all together in a rousing performance. And as I say, Minnie Driver, who will be live tonight at the Jewish Community Centre, introducing the Mostly British Film Festival.
Now, you said it's a mostly British film festival, so what's being represented on the non-Brit front?
Well, a good example would be a movie called Swerve, as in S-W-E-R-V-E, which is a juicy Aussie thriller about money, about love, about revenge. It's filmed in the beautifully scenic Flinders Range of South Australia, for anyone who's visited the country. And it kicks off with what I can only describe as a suitcase full of $100 bills. And from there on, the story moves out. If you like Australian movies, and I can highly recommend some of the great classics I've seen over the years from Australia, this would be another good example. His Master's Voice is also playing this week, and this is an unusual film directed by Nim Conti, an offbeat documentary, I think is the best way to describe it, which looks at the underappreciated art of ventriloquism. There are scenes of Conti's past life performances, as well as the work of other ventriloquists, demonstrating the skill that goes into making puppets talk. So it's unusual. I have always found the art of ventriloquism slightly confusing, since it's really important that the dummy speaks with a different voice to the actual performer. And I think this particular movie, it's called Her Master's Voice, really does delve into just that type of thing. Beyond the regular stuff is a series that some people may have seen over the years called Six Up. And this is based on a history of a group of children who started being recorded when they were in their early years at school in England. And every 10 years, they have moved along and caught up with them. So it's like a bio of a group of people's lives. The producer is now age 70. Six Up is now moving into contemporary time. So we've seen people go from really childhood age through their teen years on into adult careers, and they are speaking in their own voices. So I think just from the history point of view, how does a life develop? Did they fulfill their expectations? Were they disappointed? This, too, I think is a wonderful piece of filmmaking.
Peter Robinson talking about the Mostly British Film Festival. Information at mostlybritish.org. Do go on.
And the closing film is called The Runway. And this is a thriller. It's extremely contemporary in the sense it's set in the time of the Irish Troubles from the late 1990s, about a woman who is really pulled in by MI5, that is the British intelligence team, and really asked to play the role of an informer and threatened, if she doesn't, that her family will be off to jail. So this is an example of what we use by the word mostly British. We have Ireland, we have Australia, and we also have some films from South Africa, as well as classics from the days of film noir in terms of the British films. I think this is a good example if you want to catch up in a small theatre, have engaging conversations, have a worthwhile introduction of seeing something worthwhile. Well, now, there is one contemporary film I did want to include, which is not part of this festival, and it's the bio version called Hitchcock. For people who have not seen it, I should add, it is primarily really based on the making of Psycho, and Anthony Hopkins, with extremely good makeup, plays the role of Alfred Hitchcock, and Helen Mirren plays the role of his wife. I really enjoyed this, both as a study of what perhaps his marriage was like, mm-hmm. Particularly good on Hollywood in the 1950s and the 1960s, and in this particular case, good on the art of script writing, because you see the story being composed behind the story of Psycho.
Yeah, I know there's some liberties taken with the script, and
there
it's
are
not
some
all,
liberties
all
taken.
Completely true. It's well worth seeing. Yeah.
Well worth seeing, and I maybe will get away with my one famous line, or favorite line, I should say, from the film, when Alfred Hitchcock is being introducing himself to a new director, and he wants to be informal, so he says, call me Hitch, but hold the cock. And I realized that
all right.
he got away with it in the movie.
He could. So and I think we just got away with it on radio.
On the radio, but I didn't hear it, but he did say it.
On that pleasant note, Peter Robinson, I thank you for sharing your insight into Hitch, which is in theaters all over the place, and for the Mostly British Film Festival, information which you can find at mostlybritish.org. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, David. Good to be here. Good to see you.
Indeed, the Mostly British Film Festival happening at the Vogue Theater on Sacramento Street in San Francisco. Again, mostlybritish.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for helping out in production for today's show of Open Air. And in the background, a little bit more music from the Peninsula Symphony, which is performing this weekend, Friday in Redwood City, Saturday in Cupertino. In the background, Arturo Marquez's Danzón No. 2. I've got a number of pair of complimentary tickets that we're happy to offer to listeners who call 415-841-4134. The Friday performance at 8 o'clock in the Fox Theater will be preceded at 7 by a pre-concert talk by yours truly, as will the Saturday performance on the 19th in Flint Center and at De Anza College in Cupertino, 8 o'clock. Tickets for that also available for folks that might want to give me a call here in studio, 415-841-4134. And the folks at the Peninsula Symphony have been very generous. We're also offering, in addition to those tickets, a CD which includes highlights of the past 5 years of Peninsula Symphony performances. 415-841-4134. If you'd like to go to the Friday concert at the Fox Theater or the Saturday one in Cupertino, call now at 415-841-4134 as we listen to the conclusion of Arturo Marquez's Danzón No. 2. That program will also include the Peninsula Symphony in its entirety with Quartet San Francisco performing music of Piazzolla and Jeremy Cohen original works. Hope you can join us for that. I'm David Latulippe. Thanks again for listening today. Thank you. music for Toru Marquez, Danzón No. 2, presented this weekend as part of the Peninsula Symphony Concerts in Redwood City and Cupertino. Tickets still available for those performances, complimentary, thank you to the Peninsula Symphony, by calling our studio line right now, 841-4134. We can give you tickets to either the performance in Redwood City or in Cupertino at the Flint Center there. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks again for listening to Open Air. Tune in again next week.